Welcome to Maine's Political Pulse. I'm Maine Public News Director Mark Simpson in for Erwin Gratz, and it's time to look at politics in the Pine Tree State. This year, Maine's Democratic Party took control of the Blaine House and the State House in Augusta, but that doesn't mean it's been an entirely smooth ride for Democrats, especially progressives. Our political reporters Mal Leary and Steve Missler join me today from our Augusta Bureau to take a closer look at some of the issues and legislation that's created friction within the party and talk about how that plays out for Republicans. Steve, Mal, welcome. Good to talk to you again.
You too.
So, Mal, let's go to you. First up, we're still wrestling with a proposed $8 billion budget. Last week, we were monitoring going into the weekend to see if some deal might be hashed out over those weekend days. This weekend, are we going to be watching this? And what progress have we seen so far?
Considerable progress has been made. A lot of the things we were talking about, for example, the amount of money going back to the cities and towns through revenue sharing, that's been agreed to by the Republicans and Democrats on appropriations. What we're down to now is an interesting game that goes on, or as one former legislator called it, a dance, where we have a chunk of money that's left that's not spent. And that has to be allocated. Now, some folks want to put more of it into the rainy day fund for the future. Some of it needs to go into the Medicaid reserve account in case we have more people apply for Medicaid under the expansion than expected. And some needs to be left aside or should be left aside for all of these bills that are on the appropriations table. There are literally scores of bills that add up to over $300 million that have passed through the legislature and are sitting there waiting to see if there's any money to fund them. This happens every year. Both parties want to do it with certain pieces of legislation. And that's the dance that's going on, the discussions that are going on right now to close the budget. One of the problems that always happens at the end of the process is this is no longer an appropriations committee process alone. Legislative leaders have now come into play. That's the game that's going on. Most of it's being conducted in caucuses. Now and then we'll hear a little bit about one bill or another that somebody's trying to get in. But till they actually sit down and work it out, the budget has yet to be completed.
Well, one of the things that always occurs to my mind, and let me ask you this, Steve Missler, I mean, are there unfunded mandates that lawmakers are worried about? You think about things like education traditionally not getting enough money. Are people going to come out of this, lawmakers that is, and agency heads, are they going to come out of this happy, satisfied with the way the allocations are starting to shape up?
Well, that is always an issue. I mean, unfunded mandates and these sort of tricks that are deployed to get a bill passed that might have a financial component or a fiscal note, any administration would just say, oh, we can do that within existing resources, which always makes the agencies that supposedly have these existing resources a little bit nervous. I mean, that's the case every session, and there's going to be some of those instances coming out of this budget as well.
What are we seeing in terms of that relationship within the Democratic Party, especially around the progressive wing, Steve, in terms of how Mills politics are playing out through this budget process?
It's a really fascinating thing. We've sort of talked about it all through the session because we've kept a close eye on it. But what we saw this week, for example, was the progressive wing of the party, or at least activist groups like the Maine People's Alliance and the Maine Center for Economic Policy, come out calling for what they were calling a moral budget. Their moral budget is basically undoing all of the tax cuts and changes that Governor LePage did over the previous 8 years. But those calls to undo those were pretty much dead on arrival because Governor Mills came in and said, I'm not going to approve any tax increases. And any rejiggering of the tax code would inevitably yield a tax increase. From her perspective, they were never going to do that. And so there's some disenchantment on the left flank because of her unwillingness to do that. They talked about this week that instead of negotiating on our priorities, we're basically allowing Republicans to dictate, you know, negotiations over spending levels. The flip side to that is that Governor Mills, by declaring early on that she was not going to approve any tax increase, effectively neutralized one of the Republicans' key weapons. They're always sort of waiting for Democrats to pass a tax increase so that they can go out and then rally the troops to oppose it. I mean, this is a very old, tried and true and very effective weapon. But right out of the gate, the governor pretty much took it out of their hands. And what the progressive wing is arguing to almost give it back to them. I mean, they have policy arguments that support what they're trying to do here. They think the tax code is unfair, especially to middle income earners in the state. They think that the tax cuts that LePage passed over the previous 8 years unfairly benefited wealthy earners. But at the end of the day, this is a political game, and the governor has decided that she is not going to give the Republicans that weapon that they've utilized so effectively in the past.
And Mark, what's got a lot of the progressives really ticked off is that during this budget process, the Republicans have won their point. This budget will come in just under $8 billion instead of just over $8 billion. And as you recall, there's been a mantra among the Republicans that the budget was just too big. Well, they've gone through and done the hard work with the Democrats of identifying which positions are going to be funded that the governor proposed and which ones are not. That brought down the overall spending level. We're not talking a huge amount of money here, but we're talking about the philosophy. Well, in the politics of a budget, you've got to have two-thirds, so the Republicans have a disproportionate amount of leverage to their numbers because of that two-thirds requirement. They've been using it, but I would say they've been using it judiciously. They haven't come in and made some outrageous demands like no new positions in education. They've negotiated and gone along with some new positions in education, and that's replicated across a whole bunch of state agencies.
Well, you're both keen government watchers and, of course, know the distinction between tax boost or cut policy and tax boost or cut rhetoric. And I just wonder, sometimes we see manipulations that happen where language will say, well, we're not doing a tax increase, but we are going to mess around a little bit with the millage rate or other fees. Are we seeing anything like that in the details where some of this is a little bit more veiled, or is it really as upfront as you describe?
Well, there's always some of that that goes on. There are some proposals in there for some fee increases, for example, in the Department of Transportation. We're not talking big fee increases. We're talking about smaller fee increases. Those occur in just about every year that I can remember. I think probably in terms of monetarily wise, the biggest one would be the rebasing of what's called the hospital tax, or as I like to call it, the magic Medicaid money machine, which allows taxes that are levied on hospitals to be then matched to bring in more Medicaid money. So when you do something like rebase that, yes, you're seeing a, quote, tax increase on the hospitals, but more money's being brought in because that is then matched to the Medicaid match, which is now somewhere around $64 from the federal government for every 36 the state puts up. That's a pretty good matching rate, and while there might be some people complaining about that increase in the hospital tax, it really ends up bringing more money into the state.
Well, I won't put you on the spot for more reporter math, so let's shift over and we'll talk about Central Maine Power's proposed transmission line. Of course, a big political issue during this session, and of course the plan to bring hydro energy from Quebec through Maine to Massachusetts. Major parties split in the state on the issue. We've seen some developments both for and against or hurdles and barriers against this project play out. Notably, there was a bill to study emissions around the project that might have been a staller. It looks like that died. We're seeing a measure passing forward that would tighten up the rules around eminent domain that could also have impact on CMP. So where do we stand right now in this moment on the project?
We're kind of in a place where CMP, they've notched several victories, I would say, first in receiving an endorsement from Governor Janet Mills, and on the bill you just mentioned, which isn't quite dead yet, but is stuck between the bodies and is likely going to die, and that's the bill that would basically check or evaluate a chief claim by proponents of the project, which is that it will reduce regional greenhouse gas emissions because of the influx of hydropower. That bill can't seem to get the two-thirds support that it needs in the House, even though it has received it in the Senate, and that's why the two bodies are at odds. But yesterday was a change of events for CMP in the sense that there were two bills that passed that, as you say, would keep a check on eminent domain and also increase the likelihood that communities through which this line would pass would may even have a say in determining whether that project gets built, because if they adopt ordinances, you know, that are outright opposed to it, you know, there could be a factor in going forward. And that would shift the battleground over this project from Augusta to these localities, one of which is a population of 69 people in Carrituck. So that fight will go on. And what's interesting about that fight isn't just the fact that Governor Mills is at odds with some Democrats over whether or not it's a good idea. Politics of it aren't partisan, but populist. We've seen polling that suggests that this project is very unpopular with the public. And so when you look at the roll call votes on these various bills that would affect the project, they don't break along party lines. So those are the politics that are shaping this. I think if you were to score this, if it were a boxing match, it's a draw. But yet there are still more rounds to be fought. I suspect that those rounds will continue right up until adjournment.
Mal, I wonder, in terms of this project and similar other infrastructure projects, how controversial do we see this in the scope of decades you've been covering the State House? Is it more politically volatile than other things we've seen in Maine's history?
The closest thing I can think of to this is when they broke up the monopoly of the power companies back 30 years ago. That's what we have now, where you have the generators separate from those who distribute the electricity. Prior to that, it was a vertically integrated system where the companies generated the power and sold it to you. And that led to some real difficulties for the Public Utilities Commission in trying to set rates, because you had two significantly different factors. One, the cost of generating the power, and the other one, the cost of distributing the power. But that dispute back then really nowhere near the sort of public involvement that we're seeing in this corridor project. This one has struck me as being one of the most politically dynamite situations that we've seen dealing with utility regulation.
Yeah, and I think the reason for that is that, you know, you have a company, by the CEO's own admission last December, is one of the most distrusted companies in the state. Part of that is because of the windstorm from 2017, and the recovery efforts were slow. And also, this particular project is designed to help Massachusetts meet its renewable energy goals. It's not designed on its face to benefit Maine people. And those are two very big strikes from the perspective of people in Maine, and that's why it's so unpopular.
Steve, what about the area of this that the public doesn't usually see? And I'm thinking of the lobbying effort around this project. What can you tell us about behind-the-scenes maneuvering that is kind of leading to all these bills that the public sees surfacing up in the legislature?
Well, it's really fascinating to watch, especially here at the State House, because you can see it. And you don't see that in lobbying public disclosure reporting. And I'll explain why in just a second. But what you see when you're walking around the hallways, when you know that a CMP corridor related bill is up in either the House or the Senate, and even on days where that may not run, you'll see lobbyists from CMP or the groups that oppose it. They are stationed at every nook and cranny of this State House. And they are talking to lawmakers. They have basically a vote sheet to see, you know, who's where. And the lobbying is really fascinating, too, because I think CMP has been very effective at this. Because this is not straight up partisan issue, it's about relationships. So what they've done in some cases is they're utilizing those relationships. They've either hired former lawmakers or people who served in this building in one capacity or another, and they're using them to lobby specific lawmakers where that lobbyist and a lawmaker may have a relationship. I mean, a good example is that we've heard that Governor Paul LePage, who's no longer lives in this state and lives in Florida, is lobbying on behalf of CMP. What I've heard, though, is that the former governor has called members of Republican leadership, urging them to not approve any of these bills that would potentially halt the project. What we don't know is whether he's being compensated for that. I've been told that he's not. Some people say that he is. Seth Berry, a Democrat from Bodenham claimed that he was being compensated, but there's no proof of that. We haven't seen that in the public disclosure.
Yeah, Steve, why is it difficult to track what the activities of some of these lobbyists are doing?
To register as a lobbyist, you have to have contact with the legislator for a minimum of 8 hours. And that means face-to-face contact or preparing testimony or writing testimony for lawmakers. And that's a pretty high bar to become a lobbyist. And so a lot of this is off-the-books lobbying, where people are just basically utilizing relationships. Some of it is on the books lobbying, and it's taking place on both sides.
It's amazing. You've got the suits with the wingtips versus the guys in jeans and boots. And as Steve said, they're at every nook and cranny of the building trying to lobby lawmakers as lawmakers are going about their business. So, yeah, it's one of those things where it is opaque, but at the same time, it is very, very clear what's going on when you're in the building watching it happen.
Let me ask you, Mal, unusual 6 months into a new governor's administration, we're still talking about the old governor, and also is it unusual to think of a former governor still trying to throw sway around the halls of Augusta?
Paul LePage loved to throw hand grenades when he was in office, and he's continuing to throw them. Political hand grenades, of course. But, I mean, it is totally different from past governors. Past governors have pretty much faded away. John Baldacci, for example, is doing a little bit of lobbying, but not much. Angus King, when he left the governorship, spent 6 months on the road with his kids, you know, in a big Winnebago, visiting all of the national parks that they could visit, and then went back to doing some work on energy, which he had been working on prior to being elected to governor. Most just do not get that much involved. Occasionally, you will see them testify. I remember former Governor McKernan, who authored the bottle bill when he was in the legislature, coming in to testify on that, and it was considered a big deal because a former governor, former governor's testifying, it was so unusual. So this is totally different, but then again, what else could we expect from Paul LePage, who was totally different for his 8 years as governor?
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Maine Public political correspondent Mal Leary and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mark Simpson, and that's Maine's Political Pulse. You can access it anytime at mainepublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts. The Pulse is produced each afternoon on Fridays by Willis Ryder Arnold and music by Rob Holt. Join us again soon, and thanks.